So this morning, just after the communal breakfast, Ajahn Amaro called me over and said, "Can I whisper in your ear?" And so I didn't know what it was about, and I got close to him, and he said, "Ajahn Yanarato gave a talk about the Tudong, the pilgrimage that the two of you did back in between April and June." And I said, "Yeah." And I said, "Yeah, it was a really good talk, too." And he said, "Well, maybe people would like to hear from me," because I was the other monk. And I said, "Yes, okay, I'll do that." I told him, a few people over the last 3 years have been trying to get me to give a talk, and I've always said no. But I also said, I told Ajahn Amaro this morning, I said, but I've always said internally that if Ajahn Amaro ever asked me, that I would say yes. So I readily said yes. He's my teacher. He's been my teacher for 10 years now. So out of respect for him, and also really realizing that I probably can't fend off this moment. Okay, so that's how this all came about. So, for the benefit of those people who weren't at Ajahn Yanarato's talk 1 month ago, because it was, I think, on August 17th that he gave a talk, Ajahn Yanarato and myself undertook a long pilgrimage in Japan from April 14th, and we ended in the end of June, near the end of June, and on the island of Shikoku, which is, for those people who were at the talk, I'm sorry to, you'll hear a few minutes of the same thing. But it's the fourth largest of the four main islands of Japan, and it's in southwestern Japan, south of Osaka, one of the main cities. And it's a very ancient pilgrimage. It's officially 1,200 years old this year. They date it, I believe, if I'm correct, to the year 812, and it's associated with the great Japanese Buddhist master Kobo Daishi, also known as Kukai, and it's 88 main temples around the island. It's a circular pilgrimage, so it's a circumambulation of the island, and visiting at least 88 temples. There's 88 main temples and many other temples there. So it's a traditional pilgrimage and very much a part of life on that island. And so we undertook this walk. Now, I had originally wanted to do a long pilgrimage. Around 6 years ago, I started getting itchy feet, and I was thinking, oh, after my fifth rains retreat or fifth year as a monk, when you traditionally or usually let go from living dependent on your teacher, so you can start to make more choices of your own. And I was already getting that sort of the papancha, the sort of mental proliferations around, ooh, what am I going to do? What am I going to do after my fifth rains retreat? And so I remembered, and it was brought to my attention, a walk in Spain called the Camino, El Camino. And it's a walk that goes through a lot of Europe, but mostly from the French border through to Santiago de Compostela, which is a city in northwestern Spain. And it's to visit the cathedral there, and Saint James, the great Christian saint. And I wanted to do this, and I was back in California. I'd been here for a year, my third year, and then I got back to California, and then after my fifth rains retreat, I approached Ajahn Pasno and Ajahn Amaro, the co-abbots, and said, "Well, you know, I'd like to start spreading my wings a little bit." And they said, "Well, what do you want to do?" And so I said, "Well, I'd like to go back to Amaravati and be with Lumpur Sumedho, but also I'd like to do a long Tudong." And they said, "Oh, okay, well, where?" And I said, "You know, this is what I'd like to do in Spain." And both of them simultaneously, this was unrehearsed, they were both going, "Eh, not sure," and they didn't ban me from doing it, but they really didn't support it. And so we talked a little bit, and Ajahn Pasno finally said, "Well, do you really want to spend 2 months of your life explaining why a Buddhist monk is doing a Christian pilgrimage?" And whether that would actually be the case, who knows, but it was a good point. It was a very good point. And so I immediately went, okay, Ajahn's, you know, I take your advice. And they said, please, we support you to do pilgrimage, but find something else. So then I dropped the whole thing, and it was about a year or two later. I was living here, and I started getting the kind of itchy restlessness, wanting to do something, wanting to step out and put myself into also a more vulnerable situation. Because that's really the tudong or pilgrimage, dutanga in the Pali language is literally, I think it literally translates to something like shaking off, and shaking, you're shaking off the defilements, you know, really facing the, you know, the inner struggles, the inner demons, so to speak, that can cause us suffering and that do cause us suffering. So it's putting yourself kind of on the edge, intentionally on the edge in a vulnerable situation. So I wanted to do that, and I wanted to do it alone. I really wanted to really dive in there and put myself in a situation like that. So what do you do in today's day and age when you want to find a pilgrimage? Well, I sat down at the computer, and I went to Google, and I typed into the Google search, Buddhist walking pilgrimage, and hit enter, and boom, Shikoku. Just page after page after page on the internet of Shikoku, Japan, and I was like, I've never heard of this. So I read the first website, and I went, that's it. It's a walking pilgrimage. It's Buddhist. It's traditional, because I wanted to do something traditional. That was one of the reasons why I wanted to do the one in Spain. And so I eventually went to speak to Ajahn Amaro, and I got permission to undertake this. And then one day, Ajahn Yanarato and I, we were traveling by car up to the Japanese Peace Pagoda in Milton Keynes. And I wanted to run this past him just as an idea, just to see what he thought, you know, whether it was doable. And I said, you know, Ajahn, you know, have you ever heard of this? And he was like, well, yeah, it's like such a famous thing in Japan. You know, between 100 and 200,000 people do this pilgrimage each year in some way, shape, or form. So it's very well known. And he said, yeah, and if I remember right, he said something along the lines of, yeah, I wanted to do this, you know. And so I was sitting there quietly, and I thought, you know, I really want to do this alone, but, you know, this is Ajahn Yanarato, and, you know, this would be a really, really great opportunity to spend a time with him, but also to support him if he does want to do this. So I, about 5 minutes later, I said, you know, Ajahn, would you like to do this with me? And he went, no, I think you should do it on your own. I think you'd be better on your own, and... you know, thank you, but, and so then it was left at that, and then about six or 8 months later, I came back. I'd been in California for about 3 weeks, visiting family and Ajahn Pasano, and one of the first things that Ajahn Yanarato said to me was, I need to have a word with you about something, and so about 2 days later, he and I got together, and we spoke, and he said, you know how you wanted to do this pilgrimage, and I said, yeah, and immediately in my mind thought, he's going to tell me not to do it. He's going to say, don't do it. Immediately my little negative demon, you know, on one side of my mind was reaching for the negative. And so I was kind of sitting there going, oh, what's he going to say, you know? And then he carried on, and he started, you know, and he, you know, sort of habitual way, those people who know Ajahn Yanarato, he kind of, oh, and he humming and hawing. And I thought, what's he going to say? And then all of a sudden I thought, no. He wants to do this. He's going to ask me if it's still okay. And that's exactly what he did. And I immediately went, yes, please. You know, although I wanted to do it alone, there was this side of me that really wanted to also, you know, for many reasons, but I just thought, wow, what an opportunity to spend time with Ajahn Yanarato, you know, somebody that I deeply respect. So that's how it came about. So it's interestingly enough, when we were in Japan, and sometimes people, I picked up enough Japanese, roughly, to understand a little bit what they were talking at least about. And sometimes they would ask Ajahn Yanarato, oh, well, you know, how it came about. And those times he would say, oh, it was his idea. And they would point to the foreigner there, and they would go, oh, really? And... So that was quite a funny situation. So that's how it came about. And I think that's probably enough preamble. But just to give you a sense of the size of the island is roughly the size of Wales. I looked it up on the internet also. It's about 7,000 square miles, and Wales is 8,000 square miles, and about a seventh of the size of England, just England alone. But the walk, it's between 1,200 and 1,400 kilometers, or 800 and 900 miles, by the time you weave in and out of the valleys and do all of that. So just to give a little perspective on the walk. So for those of you who weren't at Ajahn Yanarato's talk, I can publicize it. It's on the internet also. And it's on our website. It's called Walking with Generosity in Japan. He's got two talks up there right now, but it's the older one. And it's, in my opinion, it was a very beautiful, beautiful talk. And I enjoyed it a lot, even though I was there and experienced those things. I really appreciated hearing it, because it seemed very fresh to me. So, for those of you who have read Ajahn Suchito's books about his pilgrimage in India that he undertook about 20 years ago, the two books, I think one is called Rude Awakening, is the first one, and the second one is The Patient One, or The Great Patient One, something like that, and it's a sequel. And he undertook that pilgrimage with a layman, a very good friend of our Sangha, named Nick Scott. And the way the book was written was that there are short chapters, you know, through each of their eyes separately. So Nick would write one chapter about the same period as what Ajahn Suchito wrote about, the same, very same period. And it was very clear how different their perceptions on most things were, and their inner experience of the exact same external experience. And I often thought about this while we were walking in Japan, because Ajahn Yanarato is Japanese. He grew up there. He's Japanese. He spent half his life there. I'd been to Japan once for 2 weeks on business. Their culture is very, very, I find a very, my own opinion is a very beautiful culture, very refined, very ancient culture, and very different from my own conditioning. And so I couldn't help but think that, yes, our experiences were the same, in the sense of, you know, what we experienced walking, who we met, where we slept, the views we were looking at. But we didn't really talk much about our own experiences, because we were following noble silence most of the time. But, you know, I can only imagine that it would probably be very, very different internally. And so, you know, according to our conditioning and to what we understand of where we're at. So, but I have to say that during Ajahn Yanarato's talk, everything that he said, I was in line with my experience, because a lot of what he was talking about was our physical experience, the material experience of what we were doing. So, but and two of the things that he mentioned, that, you know, I appreciated hearing, but was that, and what he appreciated walking with me was that I didn't complain, and that I was never late. I never made him wait. And I have to say that those were two things that I didn't tell him that I'd made this determination, but before the walk, or as we started, I said, don't complain to me. I was saying that I wouldn't complain, and that I would always be on time. I would always be ready before him. And then the third one determination I made was to not criticize what I encountered, either not criticize Ajahn Yanarato for anything, you know, any decision that he made, but also, and equally if not more importantly, not to criticize the people in Japan and the experiences in Shikoku. Now, that externally, I found that pretty easy, externally, but internally, the world was very, very different in some cases, not all the time, but walking, you know, walking in silence all day long and being silent most of the time, definitely my mind wasn't silent, and my mind was definitely reacting to what we were experiencing, and or what my mind was conjuring up and making into an experience, or making into some sort of quote-unquote reality. Our practice, you know, oftentimes we refer to what we've learned and different ways of working in with Dhamma is, you know, sometimes people say, oh, I've got the tools, my Dhamma tools, and I've got my toolbox. It's a fairly common phrase that you'll hear in the West. So I was really fumbling around and grabbing into the toolbox, each and every day, looking, okay, how can I work with this particular situation? And so this is why I went. This is exactly goes back to the term tudong, or which is the Thai word, but dutanga is shaking off the defilements, or shaking off the things that trouble us. If I didn't want to face those things, I would have stayed here, or I would have gone someplace else. I would have gone someplace where I didn't need to think whether there would be food on the servery, or didn't need to think if we were going to find a dry place to sleep at night, or to find a toilet, or to find a place to bathe. I wouldn't have to think about those things, like the way we live here. We're so beautifully supported. And this, to me, is a really very important way to live, because then we can put our energies into other aspects of our life, other aspects of our practice. But I really, really desired to see, okay, let's open this up. Let's go out into a situation that's very vulnerable. We weren't walking with a layperson, as most and everybody, or if not most people, know. We don't use money. We're not allowed to carry money. We cannot carry food. We cannot keep food. So it really, you're really subject to a way of living, which is very day to day and much more on the edge. And so that's what I wanted, and I think I said earlier, I got what I wanted. I got the little demons to pop up. I got to see corners of my mind that I'd never seen before. I never experienced. And I asked Ajahn Amaro before on the morning that I left here on April 2nd, and I flew to California to visit my mother and brothers, and then go on to Japan. And it's the long way to get to Japan, so if you think that's the short way, it's not. But it was. I had a lot of air miles left over from when I was a layman, so I actually got my tickets for free. So it was in the end, it was actually the more economical way to go and to see my family. So as I was leaving, I went to Ajahn Amaro in the morning, and I said, "Ajahn, any last-minute advice?" And he said, two main things that I remember him saying were, don't be surprised if, within a short while, that your perception narrows, your mental perceptions narrow to, first of all, one thing, looking after your partner, your walking partner, and how they're doing, being very sensitive and very aware to maybe their needs or their moods or whatever. And secondly, don't be surprised also if your perception narrows to really just thinking about alms food, bathing, water, the basic necessities of life. And then the last thing he said was also, don't be surprised if after about 3 weeks you're saying, who thought of this walk? Like, who dreamt this up? And so on the first two things, I would say he was absolutely spot on. About caring, being sensitive to the needs and situation of the walking partner, and perception narrowing to just being attentive to the needs of the body. But on the third one, Ajahn Amaro was wrong. After 3 weeks, I wasn't asking that question, who thought of this? It was actually 11 days. Or 10 days. I've got it noted in my diary, because I just started laughing. I didn't laugh out loud, but it kept coming up one day, and I thought, geez, it's only been 10 days. And I'm saying, okay, ahimsako, why did you do this? And also the first 10 days were in some ways quite difficult, because we just were trying to find our way. Ajahn Yanarato spoke a bit about this as well. Like, how does it work here? Their monastic tradition is so different there, because they're allowed to use money. They're, in most cases, the monks and nuns are married. It's more of a priesthood. So people trying to give us money every day and going through that sort of maneuver explaining, you know, not that we can't do that, can't accept that, and also where to go alms round, you know, what is actually appropriate for this country. Ajahn Nyanarato had done a long tudong about 23 years ago, so he knew a lot, but also this was a very different situation in some ways because it was a traditional pilgrimage. And so we were really finding our way, and it was challenging. And within a few days, I was really internally starting to feel feelings of suffering because I thought, well, are we going to be able to finish this? Can we actually make it for another 2.5-3 months? You know, are we going to get enough food? Are we going to be so weak from hunger that we can't finish? We've still got another, you know, 1,100 kilometers to go. Is it going to work? And it was interesting and useful because from the very onset of my idea to undertake this pilgrimage, I wanted to learn from the whole process and not just consider the beginning of the pilgrimage as the first step on Shikoku Island. That's a bit of a no-brainer in some ways, but many years ago, one of my brother monks in America, he undertook a very long pilgrimage through Middle America from New Orleans, and he was going to go all the way up to Thunder Bay, Canada, and a very long walk, longer than the one that we did. And he got the permission about the same time in advance as I got permission for this walk. And then he started planning and started preparing all of his gear. Well over a year in advance, he had all of his gear sewn and prepared and weighed and packed and practiced, and it was still a year to go. And I remember, you know, being, you know, I was brand new in the monastery. I'd only been there about a year. I was an Anagarika, and I remember being slightly critical internally. I never criticized him externally, but critical inside, saying, oh, you know, he's got more than a year to go. There's more than a year before. He's got his stuff weighed, you know, down to the gram. He knows. And he was aware of this, you know, even still I was critical. But he was aware of what his mind was bringing up. And he would often joke about how he was, you know, kind of obsessing about silicon impregnated nylon, you know, for making his lightweight gear. And so when I got permission to do this walk, and then all of a sudden I saw my mind going, oh, gear, right. And then I could hear my mind planning and conjuring up. And then all of a sudden I found myself investigating silicon impregnated nylon. And I just started laughing. I thought, ah. And so I did all alone in my kutia. I put my hands together and I bowed to my brother monk in California and said, okay, I got it. You know, I learned my lesson as well. But to me, the most important thing was to keep reminding myself every time I caught that thinking process, was to try and at least learn from it. To hear the echo of those words that Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Amaro keeps reminding of Ajahn Chah's words of, you know, learn from everything, so that I could learn from my inner tendency to, if I'm, you know, start creating proliferation around things, to actually try and learn, so that if I got to Shikoku and sprained my ankle or broke my leg on the first day, that all that time wasn't wasted. And for just to go back to my brother monk, what happened with his walk is that he and a temporary ordained Anagarika, just for that walk, they started out, and 1 month later, they both had to pack it in because they both got sick, like very sick. And there was no way to continue. And so after a year and a half or more of planning and having your gear weighed more than a year in advance, then the walk is gone. 1 month in, 4 more months to go. And I'm not saying this in any way to be critical. And he learned, you know, he learned from that. I know he did, and he said he did, you know, that to learn from everything. And so I was very determined I kept reminding myself, you know, learn. So when I would be out on my training walks, and I started training way too early, okay, I had my backpack full of weights and water and anything to give me some kilos, you know, sort of. And I'd be out on my walk, and when I would catch myself, you know, projecting into the future, I would say, yeah, just one step, one misstep through any of these fields, I could break my ankle, and that's finished. It's done. There is no walk. Or if I got sick, there's no walk. So am I going to get lost so far in, you know, and sometimes I was. I was lost in this, you know, projecting into the future. But fortunately, because of our teaching, you know, either after a short while or a long while, I'd wake up to the fact that I was grasping and I was planning and I was attaching to the idea of the walk. And so then, you know, when on those first 10 days, when my thoughts were, you know, the fear of not finishing was arising. And then I thought, right, yeah, you really, you know, this showed the investment of self, the investment of the idea of attaining or finishing, or that the of a goal-oriented aspect of the pilgrimage was present. And it wasn't to criticize myself, because here again, you know, our teachers keep saying, you know, it's not so much to criticize and create suffering out of that, but just to recognize a tendency within the mind, and then if you can let it go quick enough, at least this is the way I understand it, you know, if you can let it go quick enough, then, okay, there is that aspect of mind, but then the suffering can be dropped away right away. It doesn't stick. So sometimes I was lost, and I was suffering, and sometimes I was able to see it in time to let it go. So that was, you know, in terms of, you know, trying to learn from whatever happened was definitely a mantra that I kept using. But, you know, even still, you know, just the mind, you know, here we are walking in silence, and you know, for 10 or 12 hours a day or however long we were walking, and just watching how the mind could conjure up, you know, just, you know, hellish mind states. And here you are in one of the most beautiful countries and one of the most beautiful places in the most beautiful country, and encountering, you know, just kindness and wonder, you know, wonderful people along the way, and still spend often, not all the time obviously, but, you know, sometimes hours of just the mind just going rah, 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 just, you know, just conjuring up some form of suffering. And but here again, it's not that I wanted to suffer, but I wanted to see these aspects of mind. I wanted to see things that maybe, you know, experience things that I hadn't experienced before. So, Ajahn Nyanarato spoke a lot about, the title of his talk here again is Walking, I think is Walking with Generosity in Japan. And but one of the things I remember him talking about was challenges around getting food, around receiving food. And it was definitely, I mean, I can definitely speak for myself that it was a challenge. The way I like to say it is that the calories received didn't equal the calories burned, okay? Just simple mathematic equation. Both of us lost a lot of weight, and it was definitely like that. But before the walk, when I was in California, there's a very nice neighbor of my mother's, and I've met him before, and he knew I was doing this walk. He'd heard from my brother, and we were chatting up in the lane above my house one day, and he was asking me about it, and I'm asking me, so how are you going to live, and how does it work? So I explained about our training rules of no money, no food, being carried, and he was like, well, how is that going to work? You know, and I said, so I was kind of waxing on about, you know, I'd read about how generous the people of Japan and Shikoku in particular were, and there's a tradition of giving gifts to pilgrims, and that I really felt confident that this would work and it would be okay. So then when I went back through California after the walk, and I'd already spent 3 weeks with some friends of Ajahn Nyanarato, an old high school friend, and her husband hosted me very generously and kindly for a homestay for 3 weeks before going on to California. And so I'd been pretty well fattened up again. And they weighed me the first night I arrived. They put me on the scale to weigh me. And the husband, he's a pathologist. So he, I don't know whether he thought he had a new cadaver on his hands or, but they were incredibly kind and sweet and generous, and so by the time I got to California, I was, I think, looking a bit more stout, and my neighbor bumped into me again. We bumped into each other, and he said, "So how did it go, and how did it work with food? Did you get enough?" And I explained, you know, how it worked, that it was very difficult. And then he said, "Oh, that sounds challenging." He said, "So what was the best thing? What was the best thing that you feel you experienced?" And I said, "Generosity." And I watched his face go, "But a minute ago you were saying that it was challenging getting food." He finally came out and said it. I said, "Yeah, but the balance of calories received and calories burned had nothing to do with a lack of generosity. It had nothing. I mean, every single day there was some form of generosity. And if people wanted to help us material, and in many cases they couldn't, it just wasn't possible. And where we were standing, their situation, maybe they had to get onto one of the tour buses of pilgrims, maybe there were no shops nearby, maybe all they could offer was money, which we couldn't receive, or maybe they would just reach into their pocket and give what they could, some sweets, or they'd run back to their car and grab what they could. So there was never a lack of intention or generosity, or generosity of just support, you know, encouragement, you know, like the little boy one day who passed me on, we passed us on a bicycle, and it had been a very difficult day. It was one of the few days we didn't receive any food, and we'd walked a long way, and it was sort of the end of the day, and we still had a long way to go, and this little boy, very little boy on a bicycle, cycled past, and in Japanese said, okio sekete, which means travel safely. You know, may your journey be safe, something along that lines. And he said it with such a pure heart, and with such a lovely look on his face. And then he kept moving, and it was just so uplifting to me. You know, it's just like, okay, no food, many miles to go, but that's the spirit of the people, that you would hear this many times a day, or gokuro sama desu, which means, you know, I appreciate your practice, your hard efforts. I appreciate what you're doing. And so even if people couldn't give you something material, you know, it's a bit like what Ajahn Amaro was speaking about this morning, you know, the gift of attention, just noticing that there's a human being making an effort and wishing you well. Or the time that we were standing Pindabat one day and at the top of a mountain, you know, at a mountain temple, and we were really doubtful that we would get any food there. And because most people approach this on a tram, or what they call a ropeway, but it's actually a tram or a funicular that comes up the mountainside. And so every 10 or 15 or 20 minutes, this thing would arrive, and then lots of pilgrims would get out. And usually they'd have a tour guide or a pilgrim guide, and they would be on a schedule, because they would be maybe only doing this the entire pilgrimage in 2 weeks. So they've got to move. They've got to keep moving. They might have a few temples to go to that day. So they would arrive, and then the tour guide would be bringing them up the next 5 or 10 minute walk to the temple. And many, you know, quite a few times they would stop and try and maybe offer money or try and offer something or at least acknowledge us. And then, but we weren't really, no material offerings really had come. So we were standing, and it was just this beautiful view off the mountain. We were just standing. It was just so blissful to just stand there and see this beauty. So, you know, I was in a very positive mood that day, but I was like, well, you know, doesn't look like we're going to get any food. And then my mind, all of a sudden, it said, you know, the thought came up that, you know, how many people don't even get noticed? You know, how many people that are, especially maybe people particularly in a difficult situation, or sometimes you see, you know, people, homeless people, or people on the streets of London or some big city or any place, that aren't even noticed or aren't even spoken to. People don't even acknowledge their existence. And I remember the thought came into my mind as well that the one time I visited Wat Nanachat in Thailand, I was a layman. It was a year before I came to the monastery to live. And Ajahn Jayasaro was the abbot. And I spoke to him one day after the meal, and I asked him a question, because I said, well, I had a bit of a struggle sometimes being in London, that I would see homeless people or people begging, and I also had a perception based on hearsay that a lot of those people would collect money and then buy alcohol and drugs. And whether that's true or not, I'm not entirely sure, because I couldn't see that. But there was a lot of professional beggars that would do that, apparently. And he said, that he had actually tried, if I remember correctly, he had actually tried a period of intentional homelessness to experience that, you know, before he was a monk. And he said one of the things that he felt, and hopefully I'm getting this correctly, was that just to be noticed and acknowledged, to actually have somebody look at you and see that, oh, there's a human being sitting here. Okay, even if they don't give you anything materially. And so that was very helpful for me, you know, and to hear. And then that thought came up in my mind when we were standing on this particular mountaintop, and I thought, because I was just so grateful to that people were acknowledging us and encouraging us, that even if they couldn't give us something or didn't give us something. And as it turned out, that day we ended up with way too much food. You know, the mind had given up the thought of receiving food, and we just ended up with way too much. And fortunately, it was the type of food that we could give away later that day, but as we couldn't keep it. But that's how it worked. But it was interesting going through that sort of thought process, that sort of emotional process that we experienced. But yeah, definitely the receiving of food. And my own mind, I noticed that most of the suffering, that most of the stress that I experienced around food, it was really only in the morning. You know, I noticed this pattern pretty early on, that because there are only certain areas, because it's also not a very populated island compared to most of the rest of Japan, and oftentimes there's, you know, long distances without anything, and so we would have to sort of be strategic. Okay, we need to get to such and such a place to try and go to an appropriate place to do alms round, and so sometimes that was not very far away from where we had slept, and sometimes it was, and so whenever it was far away, I noticed that I really wanted the Ajahn to walk faster. Okay, I was like, I never said anything, because that was part of my thing also, to not make any request, except for if I need to use a toilet and I'm desperate, then yes, I'll ask the Ajahn. If I'm desperate for water and I'm empty of water in my bottles, I'll ask the Ajahn. But that was the only things. But I could feel this energy, just like, oh, Ajahn, quicker, or Ajahn, no, let's not take a break now. Please. Or if the break was a little bit too long, I could kind of feel like, wanting to look at my watch, you know. And I could feel that, so to at least give ourselves a chance to do alms round, you know. It's one thing, you know, I mean, I do fasting every year, and it's no big deal, because, you know, that's intentional. I undertake that on my own initiative. But it's another thing when you're walking a long way, and your body is kind of, wanting food. But I could really feel this. So, and then it was interesting, because even if that day, even if we didn't get very much, even if it wasn't really as much as the body could have really used that day, afternoons were peaceful. It was totally peaceful. Even though I couldn't say, it's not like here where if you go alms around in Berkhamsted, you know, or Hamel or wherever, and then you can go and okay, you don't know whether you're going to get anything, and I've never gone in there and not received food, but you know at least that you can get back here and there'll be a cup of tea, and you can put some sweetener in it of some sort, or might be a piece of chocolate or a piece of cheese or something. And then, you know, the chance of there not being a meal on the servery the next day it's a very low chance of that. You know, I mean, this monastery, there's never not been a meal here at this monastery, as far as I've heard, ever. So that you could say, well, okay, at least tomorrow I can have more. But there, you couldn't say that. There was, unless we had a specific invitation, which, you know, we did have a few times, You couldn't say, well, okay, nothing today, or very little today, but we could have something tomorrow. But even knowing that, afternoons were peaceful. And I found that quite interesting. And I think it was the mind just, it's sort of like, well, it's a done deal. It's a done deal. Okay, today is finished. And yeah, tomorrow, not sure again, but at least today is done. And there were other things to consider for today, like where we would sleep. So it was interesting, just that difference in morning and afternoon peacefulness around the same situation. But that energy of the mind wanting to fast, even walk faster than Yajan. And I never said, he hasn't heard this. He'll have to listen to the MP3 of this talk. So I never conveyed that to him. So, and the other thing, you know, around the walk that I found quite challenging was, and I'm glad to have really seen this, was that to realize that even our life here in the monastery, as a junior monk like myself, that we have a lot of say, we have a lot of perceived control around how we shape our day, how we shape our time. And yes, you know, we're expected to be at morning puja, evening puja. If we've got duties, if we're supposed to be at a work meeting or a business meeting or someplace, we're supposed to be there. But if we actually add up all the 24 hours of the day and add up the time that we actually can make choices of our own, it's a lot, at least in my mind. And of course, in Shikoku, I could have done the same. I could have, you know, gone AWOL. I could have struggled with somebody, with Ajahn Yanarato's pace or schedule or whatever. But I chose, I didn't want to, because I don't like to do that. As a person, I don't like to do that. And B, out of respect for him, and just also for the harmony of the walk, you know, I said, okay, his pace is his pace, I do his pace. Going uphill, I wanted to go faster. My uphill pace just happened to be a lot quicker than his. Going downhill, his was a lot quicker than mine. Because I found that every time I slipped or fell, it was going downhill. And so I realized that was a weakness of mine, so I needed to be a bit more careful. Whereas going downhill, he was oftentimes getting ahead. No problem being him ahead of me, because he could always, you know, I would catch up eventually. And it didn't happen so often that we got separated. But going uphill, for me to go beyond him would be incorrect. And so, but I could feel this sort of, you know, oh, I want to move. Well, am I going to make a problem out of that? You know, am I going to create suffering for myself or him by wanting to go faster? You know, or around when we stop, when we start. You know, just to follow. So, literally being together. I mean, the only time we were really separated was if maybe there was, you know, one of the toilet or something at the temple we were visiting. Like, okay, Ajahn, you use first, I'll use a second. So otherwise, we were generally within a few feet of each other for 10 weeks, 10 or 11 weeks. Our tent would be set up very close to each other, just out of practicality. Or if we were generously given indoor accommodation, we were just within a very few feet, sometimes just side by side because of lack of space. So to me, it doesn't matter. I realized that it didn't matter which human being I was with. It probably could have been anybody, you know, and here's a person that I deeply respect. And I still was kind of like, I want to be alone. You know, I could really feel this inner voicing. I want to be alone. And when this really came to light was one night, I was having trouble with my feet. I got athlete's foot because we'd had a lot of wet weather and my feet just never dried out. And I got a case of athlete's foot that was, and a gash, a split in my foot, which was severe enough that I really needed to be careful. And a lay supporter in Japan was sending us some medicine onto one of the next cities. But I need to be attentive, and so we stopped in this little fishing port, and it was dark. And to cut a long story short, I accidentally left my two very high-tech, lightweight water bottles behind. wasn't just like an empty Evian bottle. It was something very high tech that somebody had spent a lot of effort and money to give to me. And I left them both in the dark there down at the port. And then that night we were going to camp outside of a Shinto shrine up on top of some hills about another 4 miles away from this port. And we got to about 3.5 miles, and I reached back for my water bottle, and I went, oh, darn. Stupid. That was really dumb. And so I said to Ajahn Yanarata, I said, Ajahn, I left my water bottles back in the port. And he says, I said, I'm going back. And he said, no. He says, you had to, I have to, I'll give you one of mine. It was absolutely instantaneous. He said, I'll give you one of mine. He says, I never use it. I haven't used it yet. And I went, no, Ajahn, I'm going to go back. We'll continue on. We'll find our camp spot. I'll leave my gear. I'm going to go back. And so it was already about 9 o'clock at night, 9:30, fully dark because it gets dark early there. And so we did that. And then it was after I dropped my gear and I just had my flashlight and my pilgrim stick to identify me in the dark, just in case people thought, who the heck is this walking in the dark? Because it was really out in the wilderness. And it was only when I was walking alone, that was about the first time that I'd walked alone that was probably about 6 weeks into the walk. And it was going to take me, I was quick. I got up and down and up the mountain really quick, but it was like an hour of being alone. And then I realized, wow, because I flew. I was just like flying down this mountain, also not having 23 pounds on my back. And also being eager to find my bottles just in case somebody did pick them up. Japan is the most amazingly honest country in the world, I think. It's probably the most, you can leave things on the ground and come back and they're still there. Apparently, even in Tokyo, I've heard wallets can be left, let alone two water bottles in a little fishing port. So but it was, more interestingly enough, it was to watch the heart kind of saying, kind of delighting this quote-unquote freedom, the freedom of not being behind somebody. And here again, this is no way criticizing another human being for being in front of me, but just that realizing just, oh, wow, I can go my speed. And then also feeling the happiness of that and then going, well, is that my refuge? Am I going to, when we got back on the road the next day, And I remember it was quite a difficult walk the next day. And is my refuge going to be around having it my way? I mean, this is, it's things that we've all heard before. I mean, this is nothing unique in any way, shape, or form. But here again, it's like, the toolbox of our teachings kept popping up. So that surprised me. I didn't consider that before the walk. I considered the distinct possibility of maybe shortage of food, but the other aspects, the sort of inner world of the desire mind around being with the same person, for that long. Because I think both of us, at least my perception is that we're both quite private people. We both cherish our solitude and things like that. So, I'm not used to being with anybody. Even if it had been a different human being, every day, I think just the fact of being close to a person, I would have, hopefully I would have seen these inner desires. So, one other thing that came up for me that I'd never seen before was fantasizing about food. I can't ever remember. I mean, I sure must have at some point in my life, but I wasn't much of a quote-unquote foodie in my lay life. I used to have a pretty boring menu even at home, three or four things that I would, just rotate through cooking. I wasn't that interested in food. I liked it, but I wasn't that interested. And in the monastery, I rarely think about food because we're so beautifully supported here as well. There's not really much to think about. You don't have to fantasize here because it usually turns up on the server. But with the shortage or definitely less food coming in, all of a sudden I was like, I was fantasizing about food. And nothing special. I was actually speaking with one of the other monks this evening at tea time. It wasn't like I was thinking of anything special at all. It was just like, just a bowl of rice. For instance, the first few weeks especially, maybe even the first 6 weeks, you know, having rice was very rare for us. Maybe once a week, once every 10 days, maybe even, I can't remember it. You know, because people would give what they could, but often it would be some sweets or some fruit or something that was easily traveled. And occasionally we might get a little clump of rice or something. But just fantasizing about a simple, plain bowl of rice, I was starting to fantasize. And then I started thinking, well, when the walk's over and I get back to California, maybe my mother could just cook a big pot of rice. And I can just eat rice. And maybe if she's got some of that Japanese seaweed, I could just get that too and some soy sauce. And I thought, this is funny because I never think about food. And then I remembered Ajahn Amaro often, you know, I've lived with him for 8 out of the last 10 years. And I remember he often brings up the reflection on what he refers to as the reptilian mind or the reptile brain. And even I think the other day he mentioned it in his one of his talks in the retreat center. And it's around the sort of basic primal, ways of living, of like seeing things and saying, can I eat that? Can I eat it? Or can it eat me? Or can I procreate with that? You know, it's just the basic core of the inner mind. And so with the food, it was more like, you know, the body was, I think, and I did speak to Ajahn Yanarato about this, we were calling it starvation mode because our bodies were losing weight quite rapidly. And I really believe, without knowing this in any way, I'm not an expert at all. This could just be my own idea, but that with the body, you know, the body craves what it needs. It's like, you know, at least I've heard that, like, when women are pregnant, that oftentimes there'll be maybe a food craving, and that might be otherwise considered maybe slightly different or odd or whatever, or maybe food combinations, but that it's the body craving certain things for the baby, for the growth of the baby. And so I was just thinking, like, okay, the body, and I know because of my previous life as a ballet dancer, you know, and having to look after my body and that, you know, like being very attentive to what it needed, that, you know, I would often listen to my body. And I think we all do. I think even intuitively we do that. So I think just here again, you know, the mind fantasizing over a bowl of plain rice was just saying, yeah, you haven't had any of that type of food. The body knew what it needed. And so it was great. For me at least, I was trying to look at the sort of the not-self nature of that, you know, the sort of the emptiness of that craving, and not to take it personally, like, oh, start criticizing myself for having food fantasies. You know, so am I going to compound that sort of, okay, the mind was getting caught up in it, and then I caught it, and then, you know, am I now going to create suffering out of that mind state? And then, you know, reflecting on Ajahn Amaro's words, no, this is just the basic, as far as I can see, this is just the basic need of the body. This is not actually, you know, who and what I am, you know, because, you know, it isn't. It's like I said, it's the first time I actually can remember ever fantasizing about food. And also, you know, I think one of the clues was that I wasn't fantasizing about something special or fine or fancy or demanding. So that really came up strong. And then another thing around that was that we had an invitation to stay with a good friend of Ajahn Yanarato, who lives in the north side of the island. So it was about two-thirds of the way around in a city called Matsuyama. And this person, he's got a lot of experience with our Sangha. He's stayed at Wat Nanachat for a number of months as a layman. Also, he stayed in New Zealand at Wat Bodhinyanarama. Ajahn Karuniko, who lives at Chithurst, he has also stayed with this man in Matsuyama. He knows him well. And so he knows our tradition, and he said, look, you, when you get to Matsuyama, you stay here with my wife and child, and I will support you, and you can stay as long as you want. So for weeks, there was a sort of light at the end of the tunnel. Ah, Matsuyama. And all of a sudden, you know, when we entered that prefecture, or even before that, that county, we were seeing signs that said Matsuyama, 180 kilometers. You know, and I caught my mind sort of saying, okay, how long, 180 kilometers, how many days is that? You know, and sort of calculating. And then, you know, also thinking of my, you know, the fantasy of my bowl of rice, you know, or whatever. And not very beautiful mind states, particularly. And so then we got there, and it was just so beautiful the way this man, he actually hiked up into the mountains the day before we arrived there, and he met us up in the mountains, up in this mountain valley, and met us on one evening, and then we walked together down into the city where he lived. It was a very beautiful way to support us and greet us. And then we ended up staying there for 4 nights. And I mean, I just can't tell you how generous and supportive he and his family were. And but it was interesting because within one day, all the fantasies disappeared. All it took was a few bowls of rice. That was it. And then, but I knew, you know, we knew we would be getting back out on the road, and what we coined or started referring to as back to the battlefield, the battle of Mara, back to the battlefield, and we were very much revitalized and replenished by being with this man. But it was funny because we were back on our own, at least my own mind. On the first day that we went Pindapat, alms round, after that, we'd had a very long walk to get to the temple where we could stand for alms. And we stood, and it looked like a challenging place, just the kind of layout where we were. It looked like it might be challenging. And in the end, sure enough, we just received just a little handful of food each. And people tried, you know, a lot of people tried to give us money, but there was just no place to buy food. And but I just laughed because I just said, "Yeah, Mara, you're just kind of reminding us, or reminding me at least. I don't know what Ajahn Yamarato, how he related to it mentally, but I just had to laugh and just say, yeah, it's just reminding, yeah, we're back on the battlefield, you know, that those 4 days of beautiful support." Yes, that was there, but now we're, you know, this. It's remembered that it's really, it really truly is not a sure thing. So, but I know I realize I've been talking about food a lot, but it's that human thing going back to the reptile mind. Is it, and also Ajahn Amaro's advice that don't be surprised if your world narrows, your world starts narrowing, and to see that. To go backwards to what I said in the beginning, that of why I did this was to be vulnerable, to be, you know, I'd never experienced that. I'd never experienced that much vulnerability. And I think, you know, especially as samanas, as religious seekers, and in especially in our tradition, being an alms mendicant tradition, I'm not looking for more suffering. But I'm looking, you know, I don't feel like I can let go of suffering until I see it. If I'm not seeing those little corners of my mind, the things that I do grasp at, the things that I'm really holding on to, or the things that my assumptions or things, if I don't see them, you know, if people, let's say they don't have any nerve sensation for some reason, maybe they've damaged a limb or something, and they have to be very careful about picking up something hot, because otherwise they might not realize it's in their hand, and they might not know to let go. But so if I don't realize, you know, what I'm holding, and if I'm just keep holding it, you know, it's just going to keep burning me. So I really wanted to see things, and there were a lot of things that I saw that I don't want to share. You know, I don't feel that they're really. They're just a little bit too private and personal to share publicly. I'll probably share it with Ajahn Amaro or my teacher at some point. It's not necessarily embarrassing, but I just think I don't need to air them. But just to see things, to see corners of the mind and see things. And so I think just to kind of wrap up, because I've been talking a long time, but I think as much as I wanted to learn from the whole process of coming into this pilgrimage to try and learn from everything in the beginning, is to also learn from the pilgrimage for as long as I can. And not to hang on to it, but just simply because when we were there, there's a practical element of that, is that because we were moving so quickly and experiencing so much, you know, coming, you know, moving, seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, thinking, all of that, meeting people, being on the edge, considering, you know, just being alert, that there wasn't a lot of time for sitting, you know, silent meditation or stillness. And it wasn't really till I got to California for 2 weeks, and fortunately, like, the home situation with my mother and brother is very, very spacious, and, you know, in terms of, and they're very undemanding in terms of my attention. So I was actually doing a lot of sitting meditation, a lot of time in solitude, just being quite quiet. So then all of a sudden, the opportunity to reflect and to allow those experiences to bubble up. And so also coming back here, we went almost immediately after I returned on August 1st, we went into a week of silent group practice. And then in 4 days, I begin a month-long of solitary retreat. So already, you know, having more regular silence and quietude and stillness, I've really, so much has been coming up, you know, just memories, you know, just, and to actually kind of reflect, and to learn from those things, so that I hope that, A, first of all, I hope that that continues, and B, most importantly, I hope that I can actually relate to those things skillfully. Because that's really up to me, you know, if I'm going to, you know, just miss the opportunity or consider them unwisely. So that's the thing. And here again, to not be so desirous of wanting that to happen that I'm creating suffering. You know, it's just that really trying to hit that balance. And I have no idea whether I'll be able to manage that. But that's the hope, that I can continue to learn. But so I want to publicly, even though Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Yanarato are not here this evening, I want to just, you know, publicly voice my really, really sincere gratitude towards the permission to do this, and then also the support of Ajahn Yanarato and his kindness and guidance and just the steadiness that he exhibited. You know, it was really, you know, the whole thing, and also just the Sangha, you know, having this place, a place to be able to step out of and also to come back to, you know. Those are really precious things. So, yeah, these are really, really huge appreciations that I'm holding, and grateful for that. So grateful for the opportunity. And yes, I do want to do big walks again. I'd even go back to Shikoku. I might do it next time alone if I ever do it. Maybe up the ante, raise the bar a little bit. You know, not being able to speak Japanese could be an interesting challenge. Ajahn Yanarato was the front guy. I could just stand there, keep bowing. Hi, yes. So anyway, I think I've spoken for more than long enough, and for this evening.